You're listening to Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and considering we are in the Pacific Northwest, and today's show theme is Unplugged, we might as well name the elephant in the room here.
This is our first record. Most people don't own it.
Yeah, we couldn't make it through the hour without talking about the first thing that I think of when I hear the word Unplugged, the iconic Nirvana performance on MTV from 1993. Two decades later, that session feels like a cultural watershed. And to talk about it, we hit up Seattle music journalist Charles R. Cross. He covered Nirvana's rise when it was happening, and he's the author of Heavier Than Heaven, a biography of Kurt Cobain, along with several other books on Nirvana. So I asked Cross if it was unusual for a band like Nirvana to do one of those MTV live acoustic sets.
It was completely unusual, and Kurt was terrified of the idea. No one expected Nirvana, frankly, one of the loudest, rockinest bands ever, to have a side, an acoustic side, that would be a creative high point. I think everybody thought it would be a disaster, including Kurt Cobain.
So you were covering the music scene here in Seattle at the time. What were you doing, and was this something that you were paying attention to?
Absolutely. I was editor at that point of The Rocket, the local music magazine. We were the first magazine to ever put Nirvana on the cover. We covered their career from ground zero and day one, and Kurt advertised in The Rocket several times looking for drummers. People forget that Dave Grohl was actually the sixth drummer in Nirvana, not the first.
He didn't answer The Rocket ad, did he?
Dave did not. But one of the biggest mistakes of my financial life, certainly given how much the Kurt Cobain sweater from Unplugged recently sold for at auction, was there actually was a point in my life where I was holding a check in my hand that Kurt had filled out for a classified ad. And he was already famous, and the check was for $12. And I had to make a decision at that point. Did I keep that signed check of Kurt Cobain, or did I cash it? And there was also the principle that we didn't want to treat any of the musicians that we covered as if they were somehow special. We were part of their entity. And I cashed that check, and that was a pretty, pretty dumb decision, ultimately.
What kind of shape was the band in going into this? You know, what was the dynamic among the members, and where were they in their arc?
They were in poor shape. The band is essentially falling apart. Kurt had gone to the other band members and said, "We're a big deal now, and I want to renegotiate the royalty, not just on songs going forward, but on songs that have already been written and published. And basically, I want a bigger percentage of the money of Nirvana." And this was, in many ways, the end of Nirvana as people thought of Nirvana. Kurt dies in, you know, 1994, but the truth really was is that Nirvana was essentially over by the end of 1993 anyways.
And when they took the stage in New York, I mean, he was a pretty sick guy at that time.
He was. He was definitely a drug addict. He was struggling that day with withdrawals. You know, the story that a couple people that were involved in the production told me is that Kurt was, you know, throwing up backstage. He was laying down on a sofa. He walked into the venue, no smile, no joke, no nothing. And it was extremely tense time. And there was a significant doubt on whether he would actually be able to take the stage. One of the people at MTV, who's quoted in Heavier Than Heaven, and I guess the statute of limitations is long gone, essentially told me that she went and bought illegal drugs for Kurt, benzodiazepams, which help with heroin withdrawal and addiction, that essentially MTV, on their dime, went and bought drugs from a corrupt pharmacist so that Kurt could go on stage and perform.
Something's
things are not made like me. Don't expect me to cry.
What were the moments in the beginning of that show where it became apparent what kind of a performance it was going to be?
Well, it was a very tense performance. I think in some ways we look at the whole album and we look at the artistic triumph of what ultimately is that album. And we forget that the first, Kurt does not speak a word to the audience for the first three songs. Nothing is said. It's essentially as if you are at a symphony concert where everyone's afraid to even cough or rattle in their seats. This is not the way you would expect a typical Nirvana performance to be. And it was after, I think, the third song where one of the guys in the Meat Puppets kind of made a joke and Kurt made a joke and the air, everybody breathed. It was as if suddenly, things were easier. There is also behind-the-scenes drama, though, that needs to be noted. MTV thought that if Nirvana did an Unplugged, I mean, they literally thought that Kurt would bring Eddie Vedder on. And it would be Kurt, Eddie Vedder, maybe Chris Cornell and Layne Staley, and they would all hang together and do Temple of the Dog or who knows, but that's what MTV wanted with this. And what Kurt did instead was brought his two friends in the Meat Puppets, a band that no one in the MTV brass had ever even heard of, much more wanted on stage with the biggest commercial band of the day. And they were also unhappy about the set list because Kurt had essentially refused to play his biggest hits, and MTV wanted an acoustic version of Smells Like Teen Spirit. And they played six covers. At that point, even the uptight MTV brass executives had to admit they were seeing an absolutely mesmerizing performance.
Well, there was also these interesting little bits of interaction between him and his bandmates that it's kind of hard to interpret coming in this much later. What do you make of those, the little back and forth between him and Grohl and some of that kind of stuff?
Well, there's also the sort of backstage drama here. If you saw Nirvana live in concert, and rarely did you get the sense that Kurt Cobain was the general. Early on, one of the most ironic things, the first few times, you know, Nirvana played in Seattle, nobody thought that Kurt was even the leader of the band because he was so shy on stage. The first show Nirvana ever played in Seattle was only four blocks from where we're sitting in the studio now. And at that show, Kurt didn't say a single word to the audience, and instead Chris Novoselic, the very gregarious bass player, everybody thought it was Novoselic's band and not Kurt Cobain's. But at Unplugged, the tables have been turned. You are getting Napoleon Kurt, and you are getting Kurt, who clearly is in charge of everything. And in some ways, maybe it's fair to say Unplugged is more Kurt's album than any other Nirvana album, because he's directing the performance at every point.
Fuck you all, this is the last song of the evening.
What is it?
This was written by my favorite performer.
Our favorite performer, isn't it?
Where is a song that you really see that come through?
Well, you certainly see it in the Lead Belly song. I mean, that...
The last one.
Yeah, I would cite that. Not only is the greatest song on Unplug, I think that's the greatest thing Kurt ever did. The performance is not perfect. His voice breaks, and that's what really ultimately makes that song so great, is that you're not hearing a vocal perfect. You're hearing the emotional Kurt Cobain. You're hearing, in some ways, an inner Kurt Cobain.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, when did you sleep last night?
Kurt Cobain did not write Where Did You Sleep Last Night. You know, he did not write it, but he made that song his own in his performance of it that night.
How did Unplugged go over at the time?
Again, as many stories with Nirvana and Kurt Cobain end up, it was not as big a deal in December of 1993 as it would become in April of 1994.
Yeah, there's something very strange and dissociative looking at it now, knowing what we know now, and knowing that nobody in the room could have really known what was going to happen just a few months later. I mean,
everybody saw it. Everyone in Nirvana knew that this thing was ending. Both the band was ending, and in some ways, Kurt's life was ending. The backstory that no one wants to talk about is that by November 1993, Kurt had already overdosed on drugs a number of times, dozens of times at that point in his life. And the idea that he was even on tour was quite shocking. The concept that this was going to continue, or that this man was going to continue, was already really at play. I had the great honor, but also the horrible onus in some ways of reading Kurt's diaries for the first time truly anybody had read them after he died. And, you know, it was clear to him that he was not going to live a long life. By 1993, by the end of 93, in many ways, Kurt was even winding down in the way he even thought about his life. My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the pines, in the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I was shivering.
Charles R. Cross is a music journalist and author in Seattle, and besides Nirvana, he's also written books about Jimi Hendrix, Led Zeppelin, and Bruce Springsteen.
Thank you.